and everything turns red. We call it a redout, sir. The doctor made a personal diagnosis of acute homosexual panic. A colleague said it was psychomotor epilepsy. The old man said he didn't care what it was, he didn't want it in the Navy. So the Juicy Fruit twins, as he called them, were up for discharge. Since they had no medical record of epileptic seizures or psychosis prior to enlisting in the Navy, there was the question of a complete disability pension, and this slowed things down. Then Project Simulated Space conditions got underway and the discharge was shelved. What's going on here? I asked Jimmy Lee. Well, we're on Krupp's spaceship, or so he claims. Anywho, he's up there with charts and maps and the crew seems to obey him, most of them at least. What do they look like?
Germans mostly.
Young punks. Who else is here?
All the boys from your scripts, Audrey, Jerry, all the Jims and Johns and Alice and Kikis and Strobe, Kelly, and Dalfar. One foot in a Navy mess and the other on some kooky spaceship.
You see, there is a pretense this is just a naval station and you never know which is the pretense, spaceship or Navy. One minute you are getting popped into Maggie's, the next you're on KP or swabbing the deck. They got shore patrols out into Maggie's. Whole area is off limits. And pro stations. And I've got a rundown on Krupp. He's an intergalactically known spaceship swindler. You set out for the Big Dipper and wind up stranded in Vela de Vositok. And he's a heavy metal junk runner, known as Opium Jones in the trade. I'd seen metal junk addicts. Withdrawal is like acute radiation sickness. We sure are in good hands. Who's that joker with the doctor?
Oh, he's one of the old Navy set.
The doctor will be back any minute. I have to take a sperm specimen. They run tests on it. I start to get a hard-on at the prospect of coming in another body. The doctor is looking down at me.
How do you feel, young guy?
Horny, document. That always happens with a vertebral fracture like yours. He folds the sheet down to my knees. I can it float up and throb. A throbbing in my neck sends electric tingles down to my crotch. Jimmy sits down with a beaker and runs his fingers lightly up and down my new cock and I go off in a blaze of silver light. Jimmy's face gets black around the edges and I go out for a few seconds. When I come around, the doctor is gone. He's a creep and I hate him, Jimmy says. He used to be the doctor in a Siren Cathus. I know what that means. Money from the madam to pass her girls, in advanced stages of one of the 57 venereal diseases endemic in the cities of the Red Knight. Sometimes I wish it was one thing or the other. To Maggie's or the Navy, I complain. 6 years in the Navy and what did it get us? Give me to Maggie's. It beats swabbing decks and fucking clapper dry cunt whores. It does at that, agrees Jimmy. What about Bloom? It's open war now between Krupp and Hollywood. Sounds like a scriptwriter's paradise. It is, and that's why they drafted you into the Navy where they don't have to pay you anything but Navy pay. Got you for a pop. Same way they got all of us. So this ship is manned by the Hanged.
Sure.
That's how we all got Shanghai'd. The Germans too. Second generation. They are all artificial insemination kids from one hanged father. I closed my eyes, feeling very relaxed and comfortable in Jimmy's body, and I could remember the little Michigan lake town. Fishing was the big thing then, carp and lake trout. At 14 I ran away to join the Navy with a forged birth certificate. 2 years later they found it out and the president himself pardoned me, it was in all the papers. And I could remember this dream I kept having about a strange city with red light in the streets and then I was in a room naked and could see other people there naked too and suddenly they are all looking at me, I get a hard on and go off and sometimes one of the faces lights up just as I start to shoot. And that was the first time I saw Jimmy Lee, long before I met him in the Navy after my pardon. I was learning to be a radio operator and I'd gone to the radio room when this new kid with tech stripes looks up and smiles at me just like he did in the dream. We met in a way, that is,
Weren't you in the Double G the other night? I remembered a place I'd wandered into where everybody was looking at something I couldn't see. The way they were looking and a smell in the place got me hot, and Jimmy looking at me like that, I was getting a hard on now, so I sat down to hide it and lit a cigarette. Jimmy starts filling me in on the officers. He always knew who was what aboard ship. The old man's a real asshole and you can't smear it on too thick. Tell him you want to be buried right in the same coffin with him when you die. Anywho, I think we're getting a new CO. You see, this is a kook project with simulated space conditions and the old CO can't adjust. So they have called in someone called Krupp von Nordenhals, a Nazi war criminal, I hear, but a space expert. So forget about the old CO. Never butter a man on the way out or you can slip right out with him. Like to bunk with me? Just one other kid in the room, Jim Lewis. You'll like him and he'll like you, too. The investiture of the new CO was not unopposed and a period of chaos followed. Stepping into the hall, I saw three naked boys swabbing the corridor, wriggling their asses and goosing each other. The old CO, with the master at arms, bustles round a corner. This is disgraceful. Arrest these men. Are we going to be popped, Commander? Bare ass in front of all our mates. These men are obviously deranged. Call the medics. Reefer madness most likely. If it's dope, they are to be transferred to the prison ward. The doctor minces in. Hello there, young guys. Come along for an examination. Who's that? That's the new doctor. Well, I don't like the look of him. He's supposed to be an expert on space medicine. So what? So long as I'm CO, this is Naval Station 123 Communications. Back in his cabin, the CO found a full-length naked effigy of himself dangling with a hard-on from a lantern hook in the ceiling. Then a powder charge went off in its nuts and a roll of paper popped out the cock in a puff of smoke. The paper landed on his desk and unrolled, his resignation just waiting for his signature. The resignation of the old CO after a nervous breakdown did not end the conflict. The old Navy was still in occupation. But Krupp was winning. Smoothly Krupp moved in his Hitler Jugend boys, one looking just like another, all with rosy cheeks and yellow hair. These boys were clean, efficient, exemplary sailors and the old Navy could find no fault with them. And Krupp removed the off-limits onto Maggie's. This made him popular with the men. All the swishes in camouflage openly wore Krupp buttons, Billy Budd with a rope around his neck saying, God bless Captain Krupp. And the croaker was a Krupp man. He served on a Krupp metal junk runner when the crew broke into the cargo and got hooked on MJ. Krupp found it out and cut them off cold. This is not a charitable institution, he told the ward full of MJ. Addicts shitting, screaming, puking, ejaculating phosphorescent sperm. I leave you in good hands. Anyone reporting sick to that croaker walked out a Krupp man or he went out feet first. And the fence sitters, seeing the way the navies were crumbling, began coming over to Krupp, and since many of these were the technical sergeants, that just about sewed it up as a Krupp shop. Then one night, the Krupp men in every dorm got up before dawn and took down all the pinup girls. Oh say can you see by the dawn's early light 48 naked boys fucking, sucking, rimming on a red, white, and blue gallows and some awful Nordic shit. Krupp laps up like a cat, the boy singing his swan song in a mountain lake full of swans who convoy him reverently to the gallows. You don't have to be a space expert, just a tech sergeant, to see the old Navy game in operation, how one faction gets another out to slide in their own boys. Morning sun on morning hard-ons as the tars climb out of their bunks and stare at the walls. Where's my sex spot? A boy moans stolidly. I can't stand these kids on my walls. They're not your walls any longer. Hans, Rudy, Heinrich, Willy herein. Come in with Krupp or else. A Krupp takeover of the crew and the ship, or so it seemed. He changed the name of the ship from the Enterprise to the Billy Celeste, after a 19th century English man of war. Now all Krupp had to worry about were his own men, who had used him to get rid of the old CO, and the old Navy with its loathsome pinups and pro stations. But few of us had any confidence in Krupp. We'd seen this character operate, how smoothly he'd hoaxed us into his hanging universe. To Maggie's, the double G. But the shore leave was one hell of a lot better. We never had it so good. We could go to a licensed siren cathus where they have these deactivated sirens just give you the sex drill. The boys are getting dressed to go ashore, adjusting hangman no ties. Might pop myself a month's pay tonight. More likely you'll swing the other way. The heavy-handed kidding, it's all so young Navy. The pimply virgin there trying to act wise, he's from Virginia, so we call him the Virginian. So we all chip in to pay for a siren and watch the Virginian through the two-way mirror. Look at the dong on that kid, says the boy from East Texas. The crowd kids hardly ever go ashore, because they like to save money. Off duty they loll around in their bunks jacking off and making airplane noises. The sky is thin as paper here. Waring's house still stands. Only the hinges have rusted away in the sea air, so all the doors are open. In a corner of the studio I find a scroll about 5 feet wide wrapped in heavy brown paper on which is written "For Noah." There is a wooden rod attached to one end of the scroll and on the wall two brass sockets designed to receive it. Standing on tiptoe I fit the rod into the sockets and a picture unrolls. Click. I remember what Waring told me about the old man of the mountain and the magic garden that awaited his assassins after their missions of death had been carried out. As I study the picture I see an island in the sky, green as the heart of an emerald, glittering with dew as waterfalls whip tattered banners of rainbow around it. The shores are screened with thin poplars and cypress, and now I can see other islands stretching away into the distance like the cloud cities of the odor eaters, which vanish in rain. The garden is fading, rusty barges and derricks and cement mixers, a blue river, red brick buildings, dinner by the river. On the edge of the market, tinware clattering in a cold spring wind. When I reach the house the roof has fallen in, rubble and sand on the floor, weeds and vines growing through, it must be centuries. Only the stairs remain going up into the blue sky. Sharp and clear as if seen through a telescope, a boy in white work pants, black jacket and black cap walking up a cracked street, ruined houses ahead. On the back of his jacket is the word "Dink" in white thread. He stops, sitting on a stone wall to eat a sandwich from his lunchbox and drink some orange liquid from a paper container. He is dangling his legs over a dry stream bed. He stands up in the weak sunlight and urinates into the stream bed, shaking a few drops off his penis like raindrops on some purple plant. He buttons his pants and walks on. Dead leaves falling as we drive out to the farmhouse in the buckboard, loft of the old barn. Jagged slashes of blue sky where the boards have curled apart. Tattered banners of rain, violet twilight yellow-gray around the edges blowing away in the wind. He is sitting there with me, cloud shadows moving across his face, ghostly smell of flowers and damp earth, florist shop by the vacant lot, dim dead boy. The sky is thin as paper here. Etranger Key Passet. Farnsworth, Ali, and Noah Blake are moving south across the Red Desert, a vast area of plateaus, canyons, and craters where sandstone mesas rise from the red sand. The temperature is moderate even at midday and they travel naked except for desert boots, packs, and belts with 18-inch Bowie knives and 10-shot revolvers chambered for a high-speed 22 caliber cartridge. They have automatic carbines of the same caliber in their packs, with 30-shot clips. These weapons may be needed if a time warp dumps an old Western posse in their laps. The only provisions they carry are protein, minerals, and vitamins in a dry powder concentrate. There are streams in the canyon bottoms where fish abound and fruit and nut trees grow in profusion. They carry collapsible hang gliders in their packs. They have stopped at the top of a 1,000-foot cliff over an area littered with red boulders. Here and there is a glint of water. The sandstone substrata form pools that hold water, and even in otherwise arid patches there are usually fish and crustaceans in the pools. The boys unpack and assemble the gliders. As always, they will take off one at a time so that the lead glider will indicate to the others the air currents, wind velocities, and updrafts to be expected. They draw lots. Noah will go first. He stands on the edge of the cliff studying the terrain, the movements of dust clouds and tumbleweeds. He looks up at the clouds and the wheeling vultures. He runs towards the edge of the cliff and soars out over the desert. The glider is out of control for a few seconds in an updraft. He goes into a steep dive and pulls out, coming in smoothly. Now he lands by a pool. He waves and signals to the others, a tiny figure by a speck of water. They move 100 feet down the cliff and take off. By the pool they eat dried fruit washed down with water. Ali stands up and points. Look there. The others can't see anything. There, right there. They pick out a lizard about 4 feet high standing on two legs 50 feet away. The lizard is speckled with orange, red and yellow blotches, so perfectly camouflaged it is like picking a face out in a picture puzzle to see him. The lizard knows he has been seen and lets out a high-pitched whistle. He runs towards them on two legs with incredible speed, kicking up a trail of red dust. He stops in front of them, immobile as a stone, while the dust slowly settles behind him. Seen at close range, he is clearly humanoid with a smooth yellow face and a wide red mouth, black eyes with red pupils, a patch of red pubic hair at the crotch. A dry spore smell drifts from his body. The lizard boy now leads the way, setting the fastest pace the others can maintain. As he moves, his body changes color to blend into the landscape. In the late afternoon, they are making their way down a steep path into a canyon. Leaves spatter the lizard's body with green. They come to a wide valley and a river with deep pools. The boys take off their packs and swim in the cool water. The lizard dives down to the bottom and comes up with 14-inch cutthroat trout in his jaws and flips it onto the grass by the pool. Ali and Farnsworth are picking strawberries. Next day they set out to explore the canyon. The river winds between red cliffs. Here and there are cubicles cut in the rock by ancient cliff dwellers. We are heading for the river towns of the fruit fish people. The staple of their diet is a fruit-eating fish which attains a weight of 30 pounds. To cultivate this fish, they plant the riverbanks with a variety of fruit trees and vines so that the smell of fruit and fruit blossoms perfumes the air, which is a balmy 80 degrees. Our boat rides high in the water on two pontoons of paper-thin dugout canoes sealed over to form a sort of sled on which we glide, propelled by a gentle current, past youths in the boughs of trees, masturbating and shaking the ripe fruit into the water with the spasms of their bodies as their sperm falls, also to be devoured by the great green bluefish. It is this diet of fruit and sperm which gives the fruit fish its incomparable flavor. Little naked boys walk along the banks throwing fruit into the water and masturbating while they emit bird calls and animal noises, giggling, singing, whining, and growling out spurts of sperm that glitter in the dappled sunlight. As we pass, the boys bend over, waving and grinning between their legs like sheaves of wheat parted by a gentle breeze that wafts us to the jetty. Who are we? We are migrants who move from settlement to settlement in the vast area now held by the articulated. These voyages often last for years, and migrants may drop out along the way or adventurous settlers join the migrants. We carry with us seeds and plants, plans, books, pictures, and artifacts from the communes we have visited. On the jetty we are welcomed by a tall statuesque youth with negroid features and kinky yellow hair. It is late afternoon and the boys are trooping back from the riverbanks and orchards and fish hatcheries. Many of them are completely naked. I am struck by the mixtures here displayed: Negro, Chinese, Portuguese, Irish, Malay, Japanese, Nordic boys with kinky red and blonde and auburn hair and jet black eyes, blacks with straight hair, gray and blue and green eyes, mixtures of Chinese and Indian of a delicate pink color, Indians of a deep copper red with one blue eye and one brown eye, purple black skin, and red pubic hairs. Arriving at the port city after a long uncomfortable train journey from the capital, Farnsworth checked into the Survival Hotel. The hotel was a ramshackle wooden building of 4 stories overlooking the bay, with wide balconies and porches overgrown with bougainvillea where the guests sat in high-backed cane chairs sipping gin slings. A promontory of red and yellow sandstone 1,000 feet high cut the town off from the sea, which entered by a narrow channel between the rock and the mainland. Looking down from the balcony of his room on the fourth floor, Farnsworth could see the beaches around the lagoon, where the languid youth stretched naked in the sun. Fatigued from his journey, he decided to take a nap before dinner. Someone touches his shoulder. Ali is looking into the dim light of early dawn.
What is it?
Patrol, I think. We are out of the reservation area and the penalty for being caught here without authorization is the white-hot jock strap. We will not be taken alive. We have cyanide shoes, a cushion of compressed gas in a double sole under our feet. A certain sequence of toe movements and we settle down in a whoosh of cyanide as the green guards clutch their blue throats and we streak out of our bodies across the sky. We also have rocket fuel flamethrowers, very effective at close range. This is not a patrol. It is a gang of naked boys covered with erogenous sores. As they walk they giggle and stroke and scratch each other. From time to time they fuck each other in hula hoops to idiot mambo. Just leper kids, Ali grunts. Let's make some java. We drink it black in tin cups and wash down K rations. Draft riots. And here I was with a pop-happy skipper in an old leaky jinxed gallows-propelled space tramp with all the heaviest guns of the planet trained on us, the Countess de Gulpa, not nearly so unimportant as Pearson would have liked me to believe, the CIA and the board, Bloom and the movie studio. I figured we'd be lucky to reach Hoboken. As a matter of fact, we got a few miles farther to what is now Lower Manhattan. Four kids insisted on guiding us to the Double G in New York and when we walked in, I saw that the whole place changed. The gallows were gone but there were two nooses on the wall above the bar with brass plagues, rope used to hang Baboon O'Toole June 3, 1852. Rope used to hang Lousy Louis June 3, 1852. And a photo of Baboon and Lousy Louis standing side by side on a double gallows. The decor is now the New York of 1860, vintage crystal chandeliers and huge female nude in a gilded frame over the bar. I spot Marty sitting with four thuggish-looking wooden-faced characters drinking champagne, and he waves to me. You boys join us and have some bubbly. We sit down and the thugs give us a cold fishy who are these Nances look. The fever does convey certain advantages. We all have a virus feel for weak points in any opponent and Krupp has given us some basic courses in unarmed psychic combat. The techniques mostly run on a signal switch I love you / I hate you at rapid intervals, but this is only effective once a weak spot has been found. We soon have these four hoods in line with just the right shade of show you. Hoodlums are ducky soup. Anyone who has to be tough on the surface is riddled with weak spots. But don't try the switcheroo on the wrong people. Try it on a tiddlywink and it can bounce back with a meat cleaver. And don't tangle with some mafia don sitting in front of his grocery store. When we walk into the Double G into Maggie's, we see a heavy padlock on the gallows mechanism with a lead seal and a notice on a brass plaque, all public hangings forbidden by order of the DNA police. Yep, the bartender tells us. That's right. No more publics. It's the law. Death requires a random witness to be real and a public hanging is real because of random witnesses. In the Garden of Eden, God left Adam and Eve alone to eat the fruit of the hanging tree and then popped back in like a random house dick who just happened to be passing in the hall when he heard amorous noises. What's going on here? See any dog catchers of sirens in the street? Well, no, come to think of it. You won't. The bartender is a little, thin, middle-aged Irishman with glowing gray eyes. He is dressed in a tight-fitting green suit. He picks up 10 glasses in each hand, spreads them out on the bar, and starts polishing. We had a riot here. The boyos killed every dog catcher in Tamagis and most of the sirens. He holds up a glass to the light. The kids all want to get out to Wactus now and find the answers. I tell them every time you find an answer you find 6 questions under it, like leprechauns under a toadstool. New York the Double G 1860. A little, skinny, middle-aged Irishman dressed in a filthy green suit bangs on the bar with his beer mug and a respectful silence falls. He jumps up onto the bar, his face contorted like an evil leprechaun as he spits the words out, "The bankers on Wall Street and the she niece is buying their sons out for $300. His eyes glow and the hair stands up on his head. "And what about you and me who don't see $300 a year in one piece? We get drafted into the frigging army to fight for the frigging niggers." A bestial roar goes up. The patrons are 4 deep around the bar, brandishing clubs and crowbars. The little green man leaps down from the bar. "What are we waiting for? An invite from City Hall? Let's go." About 50 blood-mad men and boys and a few screaming harpies troop out after him screaming, "Kill! Kill! Kill!" How did the riot start? Well, you know how it is with riots. Things build up and up, then something sets it off. He tosses a chipped glass 20 feet into a trash can. The dog catchers start raiding out of fair game areas and there is a move by the hanging fathers in the city council to extend fair game areas. Then two foreign countesses, they call themselves Countess de Slutville, buy villas on the mountain and set up something they call the Genetic Institute, and there are rumors about transplant operations carried out by the sawbones they have brought in from Yaswata. That would be Van. I put in. It would. Next thing, these two boy-eating sows move in their own special police with firearms and pressure the council into passing an ID card law so anyone who doesn't have an ID card stamped and updated can be arrested and hanged in the institute. So all the boys have to apply for these cards or risk getting picked up anywhere. One night 5 SBS come in here checking ID.D.S and they start to drag some kid out. They have guns, of course. Doesn't do them much good. The kids is on them with broken bottles, knives, chairs, feet, knees, and elbows. 4 kids is killed, but they take the SBS apart. You can see the blood stains right over there. Then some little Irish kid I'd never seen before jumps up on the bar screaming, "What are you waiting for? Waiting to get milked by these foreign bitches like Randy cows? Kill! Kill! Kill!" The SBS and dog catchers are barricaded in the Garden of Delight, ready to defend the Richies with their last drop of blood, and it comes to that quick enough. They open up with machine guns, but the boys just spread out and keep coming, throwing cobblestones and Molotov cocktails. Better than 100 are killed in the few seconds it takes for the rest to swarm over the barricades and cut the guards to hamburger. Then they charge up the mountain screaming, "Death to the foreign sows!" Well, the countesses and their sawbones got their asses out to Yaswata in an auto giro. Their villas were looted and burned to the ground along with most of the other villas. The hanging fathers were thrown into the fires along with all the sirens that could be found. Some of the rich kids was with the mob, so a few big villas are still left. But the Richies sure got a new look since then. I soon see that there is more here than just a spontaneous explosion of overcrowded, poverty-ridden slums. The whole scene has been staged from above to point up the need for a strong police force, and some of the mob ringleaders turn out to be agents of big money. A young man in dirty overalls who fought valiantly with the mob was killed by the police and was found to possess aristocratic features, well-cared-for hands, and a fair white skin. Though dressed as a laborer in dirty overalls and a filthy shirt, underneath there were fine cashmere pants, a handsome rich vest and a fine linen shirt. His identity was never learned. Herbert Asbury. Gangs of New York, p. 154. Through the havoc and wreckage of the burning and looted city, through streets littered with the dead and dying, street boys dance and caper like gay insouciant sprites, many of them wearing Halloween masks. A boy in a skeleton suit flops beside a stiff corpse in grotesque imitation. "You're dead and you stink." He jumps and capers away. They prance around a dying policeman and mimic his death throes. Wadoncha get up and stop the fight. They snatch his hat and badge, chasing each other. "Stop in the name of the law," they mock. A boy snatches a coat and vest from a looted store. Another boy in fake beard and skullcap pops out. "Shoot him in the pants. Shoot him in the pants." The coat and vest is mine. They called in a new commandante who accepted the conditions of the rioters. The sirens who survived by concealing their assets someplace were confined to licensed Cathuzas or deported to Yaswada. They had to walk it stark naked. 200 miles of desert, wild dogs, hyenas, and leopards out there waiting. The kids lined up and whipped them out the gates with hangman's nooses. The bartender goes into a song and dance as he taps glasses with a spoon, singing. She's too fat for me. She's too fat for me. I don't want her. You can have her. She's too fat for me. He wipes the bar from one end to the other. And the sperm dealers has left too, most of them. Can't operate under the new conditions. And good riddance to the Gamin men. Marty has a good thing going. Operating with a friend in the records department at City Hall, he is forging quitclaim deeds to properties in the burnt out areas. When the smoke clears away, he will owning a big chunk of Lower Manhattan. The compensation and then the building contracts. The whole thing drips with goodness. He has troops of boys in the street to keep the home fires burning. And these riot boys will later be used to harass any wise citizens who try to reclaim their property and rebuild. The boys screaming insults at visitors. Eye catching one clap from fucky your asshole. Swarming over the house like monkeys, leering in at windows, throwing stones at passerby from the roof, urinating and masturbating from balconies. There are a number of these boys sleeping in the Turkish bath where we have billeted ourselves. They parade around naked doing imitations. Death throws they dig special, flopping around, screaming and groaning and jacking off while the others piss themselves with laughter. Krupp gets it together finally. Two Kraut SBS at the door. All leaves cancelled. Report back to ship immediately. Next stop, the future. Tamagis revisited. When we were first stationed in Tamagis, it was such a frantic and dangerous place that we never got a chance to relax and look around. At that time, Tamagis was in the hands of the women with their dog catchers and sirens, supported by a weak and acquiescent city council. Since the I.D. card riots, the massacre of sirens and dog catchers, the flight of the countesses and their retinue, and the appointment of the new commandante from Wakdas, power had definitely shifted to the men. The new commandante dissolved the city council and ruled by decree. The rioters are now the elite of the city, setting style and tone. The fashionable thing is to look for the answers or the questions behind sex and death. So the youth of Tamagis look to the academies of Wakdas. I am speaking about 10% of the total population. As always, the permanent parties remain, the shopkeepers, restaurant and bar owners, merchants, craftsmen and farmers. Tamagis is a walled city, circular in shape, with gates at the four cardinal points. The population is about 20,000, but the area of the city would accommodate a much larger population. Since considerations of privacy do not apply for the emancipated youth, they live by preference in dormitories and cubicle rooms, sharing bathing and sanitary facilities. This concentration of personnel leaves room for the fish ponds, farms, aviaries, and orchards within the walled area, so that the city is almost self-sufficient. And the rich, eager to disassociate themselves from the lingering taint of the dog catchers, sirens, predatory countesses, and the infamous hanging fathers of the erstwhile city council, have made their estates productive. Some have thrown their houses open to youth communes. Cow's milk is brought in from a farm outside the city walls, since the new commandante banished all cows from the city. The main square is a composite of the Jmelfnet or Marrakesh and the Mercado Mayorista of Lima, surrounded by parks and trees. I am sitting in the Red Night Cafe with Dalfar, Bluey, and Jimmy Lee drinking tea one afternoon. There is no alcohol and no tobacco in Tamagis by order of the new commandante. A kid I recognize as a former outcast, barred from the double G, is moving from table to table. Now he is a hero of the ID riots. The kids have a basket full of Zyokuddles. This small orange and red speckled snake has a venom that causes erotic convulsions and acute diarrhea and is frequently used as a practical joke in commune initiations. Of course you can get the same thing in amples or poppers, but the old folkloric ways still have charms for the rich. The boy is making a sale at a table of rich kids. Looking out across the square, I see a man pushing a cart with crates roped onto it, and one of the crowd kids is walking alongside it. Looks like Krupp is taking on some cargo. He sure is, Jimmy tells me. Right after the riots, he bought up all the nooses on the open market and all the noose material. The nooses he plans to sell to tourists in Badan. He's got all the old noose merchants making rugs, and he's shipping red hots and white angels and blue burns and black lights and green as the lot. So he cuts them with Spanish fly and sells them in the Badan Cathuzas. He sure is an operator. He's putting up the prices, the miserable bastard. We'd better lay in stock. We walk around through the bazaars pricing color poppers and afros. The price has about doubled, but we know it's 20 times higher in Badan for cut stuff. The red hots bring you out in red blotches and dots, squirming around on your red hot ass, itching to pop, and you can top it with a red pop. This can be dangerous, bringing on internal hemorrhaging or in some cases spontaneous fracture of the vertebrae. The white angels turn your jism to light. A snow pop is a blaze of cold white light with hot sex sparks. The blue burn, which is usually mixed with yeg, is cold and hot at the same time. You come out in a blue rash with a cold menthol burn, and a blue pop is like cyanide and ozone. The black light turns you black as obsidian and knocks all the white words out of your brain, so you are right there with whatever the sex scene is, and a black pop brings you off in sync. The greenie is something between animal and vegetable. You come out in a green rash, your nuts a tight seed pod popped off by the green pop. You can mix colors, say red hots with a snow pop for bells of rosy fire ringing in the sky while you squirt a choir of angels. Now, your partner may be doing the same thing, or he may be squirting blue twilight in attic rooms and distant train whistles. Or you take red hots and smooth it with a black pop and spurt deep purple. An old glory threesome, red fucking blue, who is fucking white, and red pops blue, blue pops white, and white pops red. Try the rainbow special, all colors in one, and squirt Niagara Falls, Pike's Peak, souvenir postcards, rainbows, and northern lights. Step right up, good for young and old. Young boys need it special. Sometimes they forget the heroes of the fever who made all this available to young boys. Yeah, I'm a hero of the fever. Audrey thought as they made selections. But it won't get me a discount. Yeah, I'm a hero of the fever, and knowing what went into those products, I don't like to see them cut and sold to drunken American Legion slobs. That's right, the City Fathers are setting up an American Legion convention. The Badan Hilton and American Express arrive in a cloud of pop stars. The proprietor, a thin gray old man in a gray jalaba, follows us around pointing out rare items, apologizing for the higher prices. Oh, there are some itchy tingles. Audrey explains. Just the thing for my high school Christmas play. Give me a case. Oh, and there are some furs ties. I'll take all you've got. A firsty pop is the hyacinth smell of young hard-ons, a whiff of school toilets, locker rooms, and jock straps, rectal mucus and summer feet, sugar lotion, and carbolic soap whiffs you back to your first jack-off and leaves you sitting there on the toilet if you don't keep flying speed. Never linger over a firstie. The proprietor has it all crated up. We pay him and tell him to send it to the mailroom on the Billy Celeste. I stop at a bookstall by a canal to pick up some light reading for the trip to Badan. From an old Frenchman smoking a gitan, I buy An Outcast of the Islands by Conrad, Maiden Voyage by Denton Welch, and Brack the Barbarian by John Jakes. We walk through the flower markets, florist shops, and greenhouses. Sex nettles for fraternity initiations. It's more fun than paddles. Orchids that grow into your flesh, tendrils stirring vegetable lusts. And here is a humanoid mandrake 6 feet in height. Is it a screamer? Audrey asks. It sure is, son. And when he screams, it will bring off every living creature for a 20-yard radius. And the beauty of it is, he lives on your shit, saves you installing a toilet. What makes him scream? You fuck him, son. Or jack him off or suck him off and he screams like a major. What happens if we hang its green ass, roots, and all? Jimmy asked. Son, you'd be doing what mankind has always trembled to do. You'd be upsetting the balance between the animal and the vegetable kingdom. He'd scream the planet apart. It would be the last scream. He certainly has potential as a weapon, Audrey mused. That is, if he weren't so bulky. There are bits and pieces of many cities into Maggie's. We are walking down a street of worn blue cobblestones rather like the outskirts of Edinburgh when a little boy falls in beside us. About 4 years old, I think at first. He has a rolling walk like a sailor. He is dressed in shorts with a white sailor shirt and white tennis shoes. I put my hand on his shoulder and he snaps at it with sharp little teeth. Keep your hands off me, you bastard. And I see that he is a miniature youth of 18. When we make it back to the ship with the kid, who has pulled a sailor cap out of his pocket, and get to our cabin, there are two more krauts in it. Krupp is making room for the cargo. I hope he can get it off the ground. He does. Next stop, Badan. Where naked troubadours shoot snotty baboons. Boys in cod pieces and leather jerkins carrying musical instruments from the Middle Ages invade American Express. The clerk glares and beckons to a security man. A boy with long blonde hair steps to a window. Can I help you with something? We wish to travel. Travel? Where exactly? The boys strip off their clothes, where naked troubadours shoot snotty baboons. They open up with Venus 22 machine guns, a sound like farting metal. Staff and customers like dead. Travelogue voices through the loudspeakers, they are a happy simple people slash. She wears the traditional athrump slash many moons ago they say slash he offered me a cup of smoon, a mixture of black rum and the blood of menstruating seal slash now they would show me the sacred uncle ceremony slash mixta demonstrates how the poi man su us prepared slash we stop to observe the traditional all shit that must be observed before this young peasant can blank mash his fiance slash the old ungling is sick slash can nothing be done? Slash Sanfraz the sorcerer has been consulted slash every foot of arable land is treasured slash all refuse must go into the ungern or fertilizer ditch slash the frin crop is good and there is much rejoicing slash youth scream muku muku fucky fucky over their thuma slash how long can the old ways withstand the onslaught of modern technology? Slash he say long long ago many thousand moons a red light appeared in the northern sky slash this light inflamed men to madness and many fell sick with a terrible plague slash. All that remains of the ancient city of Badan, mud walls in a waste of sand slash if these walls could speak what tales they could tell slash. What tall tales indeed. Tacitus tells us that the Scythians, a warlike and horsey people, hanged their captives from trees like an old western posse. And Herodotus gives a lurid account of their practices. When a Scythian king died, 50 pure-blooded Arabic horses and 50 handsome youths were strangled, disemboweled, and stuffed. The horses were then placed in a semicircle around the tomb and the youths mounted the horses, being held in place by a stake which passed through the body of the horse and into the ground and through the anus of the youth up to the top of his skull for good posture. A baneful red glow flares across the northern sky, bathing the city of Tamagis in a flickering red light shading from light pink to dark purple, flowing like water through the ancient twisting streets cut from desert rock which has now powdered to sand under generations of shuffling feet. The first thing you notice here is the dead muffled silence of the sand-covered streets. Now we hear music and singing as a strange procession winds into sight. Naked boys with boots of rotten animal hides crawling with nagots lead a column of horses on which boys are riding naked and bound. The carrion boys caper and whinny and rear and fart, showing their teeth like horses. Now the procession halts in front of the king's tomb and the horses are being strangled with ratchet cords that tighten and cannot be unloosed. A horse rears, baring his teeth and rolling his eyes as blood drips from his nose, the horses are turning intolerably into youths, shrinking faces spit out horse teeth like bullets. A horse rolls on its side kicking spasmodically, sloughing off hooves and sinews and hide, patches of human skin breaking through. Another rolls on its back, kicking its legs in the air as the tail whisks in between human legs, kicking human genitals, shooting horse pricks, as intestines spurt from shrinking bellies and brains jet out from eye sockets. As they emerge from the ruptured horse bodies, the youths are seized by the carrion-booted boys with long red hair and gloating idiot smiles. The youths and horses have all been strangled. It is time now for the butchery, which they attack with good cheer as one boy here tends his companions with a comic bump and grind striptease with intestine that drop off as his erect member snaps out. He sticks his tongue out and ejaculates as his friends roar with laughter. They are a simply happy people. Now there is work to be done. The horses must be stuffed with aromatic herbs and the youths impaled on stakes that will hold each boy astride a dead horse until horse and rider crumble into the red dust. The carrion boys caper away and disappear in little eddies of sand under the red sky shot with meteors and northern lights. Yipee yipee, ghost riders in the sky. In desert lands, cool stone latrine slash outhouses covered with roses in drowsy summer afternoon slash dead leaves in the pissoir slash jmces types vici or key se mont rent la bite slash find yourself in the navy slash all right you jokers hit the deck slash naked boys rolls around squirming legs kicking in the air as the colors ripple through them slash one bumps out a rich sepia with a smell of military laundry and black vomit in faded violet photo wards and it hits a delicate rose pink of seashells with the hyacinth smell of young hard-ons 1910 the young sailor in Panama yellow fever epidemic assigned to work in the wards he knew he'd catch it sooner or later than the itching started and the red rash in his crotch and ass purling in his pants he sniffs the smell of vomit and fever shivering in yellow olive green deep mahogany and black death spasms. Rainbows in faded calendars light up and blaze across the sky. Coming in for a neon landing at the Rainbow Club in Portland. When Wilson, chief of security at Portland, arrived at his office, his assistant handed him a message. The Billy Celeste, U.S. Navy from 1980 has landed and requests permission to disembark. Wilson looked at his assistant and raised an eyebrow. Fever? And how? Even the cockroaches? Wilson reached for a standard quarantine and repatriations form. That's Nordenhall's ship, isn't it? Right. Miserable old bastard. One of these days he's going to find my foot up his skinny ass. He signed the form and tossed it into the out basket. Book 3. Locker Room. It is Christmas Eve and Toby is alone in the locker room. The old YMCA building has been sold and only a few boys still stay on. They have moved into the locker room because it is warmer and the showers are there. Now all the other boys have gone away somewhere for Christmas and Toby knows that most of them will not be coming back, since the building has to be vacated by January 18, 1924. Toby is reading The Time Machine by H.G. Wells. I gave it a last tap, tried all the screws again, put one more drop of oil on the quartz rod, and sat myself in the saddle. I suppose a suicide who holds a pistol to his skull feels much the same wonder at what will come next as I felt then. I seemed to reel, I felt a nightmare sensation of falling. I am afraid I cannot convey the peculiar sensations of time traveling. They are excessively unpleasant. There is a feeling exactly like that one has upon a switchback. Of a helpless headlong motion. I felt the same horrible anticipation, too. Of an imminent smash. As I put on pace, night followed day like the flapping of a black wing. The twinkling succession of darkness and light was exceedingly painful to the eye. The sky took on a wonderful deepness of blue, a splendid luminous color like that of early twilight, the jerking sun became a streak of fire, a brilliant arch, in space, the moon a fainter fluctuating band. Minute by minute the white snow flashed across the world, and vanished, and was followed by the bright, brief green of spring. There is a stew simmering on a gas ring and occasionally Toby stirs it, listening to the chimes from the Salvation Army mission across the street playing Silent Night. He remembers other Christmases, the smell of pine and plum pudding and the old smell of his steam engine. He had been brought up in a three-story red brick house in a middle western town. When he was 6 years old his parents died, in the flu epidemic of 1918. After that, a series of uncles and foster parents took care of him. Nobody wanted Toby for long, though he was a beautiful boy with yellow hair and huge blue eyes like deep lakes. He made people uneasy. There was a sleepy animal quiescence about him. He never talked except in answer to a question or to express a need. His silence seemed to hold a threat or a criticism, and people didn't like it. And there was something else, Toby smelled. It was a sulfurous rank animal smell that permeated his room and drifted from his clothes. His father and mother had had the same smell about them, and they kept a number of pets, cats, raccoons, ferrets and skunks. The little people, his mother called them. Toby took the little people with him wherever he went, and his uncle John, an executive on the way up, liked big people. "John, we have to get rid of that boy. He smells like a polecat," Toby's aunt would say. "Well, Martha, perhaps there's something wrong with his glands." The uncle blushed, feeling that glands was a dirty word. Metabolism would have been much better. "That's not all. There's something in his room. Something he carries about with him. Some sort of animal. Now Martha. I tell you, John, he's evil. Did you notice the way he was looking at Mr. Norton? Like some horrible little gnome." Mr. Norton was John's boss. He had indeed been visibly discomfited by Toby's silent appraising stare. Looking back, Toby could see the twinkle of Christmas Eve ornaments. Far away his father points to Betelgeuse in the night sky. The locker room holds the silence of absent male voices like a deserted gymnasium or barracks. The boys have built a partition of beaverboard and set up their cots in this improvised room. There is a long table with initials carved in the top, folding chairs, and a few old magazines in the main room where the gas ring is located. In one corner is a withered Christmas tree that Toby pulled out of a trash can. This is part of his stage set. He is waiting for someone. He tastes the stew. It is flat and the meat is tough and stringy. He adds 2 bouillon cubes. Another 15 or 20 minutes. Meanwhile, he will take a shower. Naked, waiting for the water to heat up, he is examining the graffiti in the toilet cubicle, running his hands over phallic drawings with the impersonal interest of an antiquarian. He is a plant, an intrusion. He has never seen the other boys, a whiff of steaming pink flesh, snapping towels, purple bruises. He leans against the wall of the toilet as silver spots boil slowly in front of his eyes. Christmas Eve, 1923, you see the old YMCA building. Someone he carried with, Hi. It's me, Toby. His father points to a few boys still staying there, the shower's silence. Other boys have gone away. Part-time in this improvised room. Building has to be vacated by the folding time machine where the gas ring is hot occasionally. Toby pulled out of the mission, stage set, other Christmases. His part is 6 years old in the epidemic. Toilet cubicle, his old face, remote parents. Sleepy animal whiff of naked flesh Christmas geese in the sky. Silent night for someone died waiting for the graffiti in 1918. If you ask for something solid as shirt and pants walks, long sight you read the monkey's paw. Years over phallic drawing snapping towels and purple bruises. Toby dresses and walks back into the living room, as they call it. A man sitting at the table. He is thin and white-haired with blue eyes. His pants and shirt are red and white striped like peppermint. A long patched coat is folded on the chair beside him. Wisps of fog drift from the lapels. "Well, Toby, and what would like for Christmas?" "Well, sir, I guess people ask for a lot of silly things, so I'd like to ask your advice before making up my mind." "Yes, Toby, people do ask for silly things. They want to live forever, forgetting or not knowing that forever is a time word and time is that which ends. They want power and money without submitting to the conditions under which power and money are granted. Now I'm not allowed to give advice, but sometimes I think out loud. If you ask for something solid like power or money or a long life, you are taking a sight unseen proposition. Now, if you ask for an ability, I want to learn how to travel in time. Well, you could do a lot worse. Makes you rich just incidentally. But it can be dangerous. It is necessary to travel. It is not necessary to live. Toby experienced a feeling of ether vertigo as he was pulled into a whirling black funnel. Far away, as if through a telescope, he could see someone sitting at a table, a slim youth of about 20 with yellow hair and brown eyes. A fluid plop and he was inside the youth, looking out. He was sitting in a restaurant somewhere, taste of paper-thin cutlet, cold spaghetti, and sour red wine in his mouth. The waiters looked ill-tempered and tired. Now he became aware of someone sitting at an adjacent table, so obviously looking at him that they seemed for a moment to be alone in the restaurant. It was a woman of about 26, neither well nor poorly dressed, with an older man and woman, probably her parents. She had, Toby thought, one of the most unpleasantly intrusive faces he had ever seen, set in an oily smile or rather a knowing smirking cringe with a suffocating familiarity that pressed on his being like a predatory enveloping mollusk. Toby began to feel quite faint. Suddenly he spoke without moving his lips. You'll never get into a nice Gentile country club with a look like that hanging out of your Jew face. We like nice Jews with atom bombs and Jew jokes. Dead silence, wild-eyed faces looking for the source of this outrage. Ach God. A Jewish waiter slumped to the floor in a faint. Toby shifted his attention to a table of blacks. Yes, and the right kind of darka too, singing sweet and low out under the mimosa, not feeding his black face in the same restaurant with a white man and getting his strength up to rape our grandmothers. Next a table of Latin American diplomats. You greasy-assed Mexican pimps. Why don't you go back to your SYPHY Cathuzas where you belong? That's telling them. Said a Southern American voice. Go screw a mud puppy. And if there's anything worse, it's a murdering Mick with a bomb in his suitcase. A suitcase by a table of Irishmen began to tick. Toby put money on his check. He lifted his wine glass to the table of Jews. You Jews is so warm and human. I offer to you that most beautiful of all toasts, El Haim. To life. He was moving towards the door. You blacks got soul. As he passed the Latin Americans, he twitched his hips. Que rica mamba. When Irish eyes are smiling. In the doorway, Toby whipped his scarf around his neck and shouted back into the room with moving his lips, so it seemed to echo from every corner. Bugger the queen. He opened the door and heavy palpable darkness blew in with a reek of brimstone. He sprinted for the corner in a black cloud, his red scarf trailing out behind him like a burning fuse. Shouts behind him. Breaking glass. Here was 44, Edgerton Gardens. He opened the door with his key, slid in and shut the door, leaning against it. A blast outside, sirens, words in his head, air raid. The Blitz. He felt his way to his room at the head of the stairs. As soon as he opened the door, the sound of breathing and the smell of sleep told him that someone else was there. He touched a shoulder. Hello, I'm Jim Everson. Hope you don't mind doubling up like this. It's all right. Toby stripped to his underwear and slid in beside him. They lay there, listening to the explosions. The bomb seemed to walk in a leisurely way up and down Brompton Road. A smell in the room, not just of warm young flesh. It was a rank musky ozone smell, the smell of time travel. Toby woke up in a dark cottage. Mother was not back yet. He was alone and very frightened. The cottage was in Gibraltar and he knew the floor plan in the dark. He went from his room into the sitting room and looked into his mother's room. The bed was empty, as he knew it would be. The lights would not turn on. He lay down on her bed, but the fear was there as well. He went back to his room and tried to turn on the lights. None of them would turn on. Now even the light in his own room would not work. He opened the cottage door and went out. Dawn light outside, but a heavy darkness lingered inside the cottage like a black fog. He resolved not to spend another night there. Who would not spend another night there? He was two people, the boy who lived in the cottage and someone else. He saw a boat. Durban to Gibraltar. A slim